Hello, and welcome to The Staffing Show, the only podcast that delivers tools, tips, and tactics from the staffing and recruiting industry's top executives and thought leaders.
Today's podcast is brought to you by Staffing Referrals. At Staffing Referrals, we understand the challenges your agency faces every day. From finding high-quality candidates and clients to automating your recruitment process, our platform is designed to help you grow your agency faster. Imagine a world where your agency can automatically build your talent community, improve your recruiter's productivity, and automate manual processes, all the while improving the candidate experience. But don't just take our word for it. Here's what a few satisfied customers have to say. Our referral program boomed after partnering with Staffing Referrals. The technology allows us the tracking, communication, and reporting our traditional referral program desperately needed to unify and expand. Can't imagine our business without it. Are you ready to transform your staffing agency? Let's reduce your dependency on job boards. Deliver the experience your candidates expect from a modern business and turn your talent pool into a competitive advantage. Visit staffingreferrals.com and get ready to grow.
Hello, everyone. Thank you for joining us for another episode of The Staffing Show. Today, I am super excited to be joined by Jeff Bowling, who is the co-founder and partner of The Four Peers, and Eric Gregg, who is the founder and CXS of Clearly Rated. Jeff and Eric, super excited to have you guys here today. I'm going to be digging into some cool conversations, talking about market trends, leadership in turbulent times, some growth strategies, and also touching on how you can measure performance. To kick things off, Jeff, could you give us a little bit of your background and tell us how you got in the staffing industry and a little bit about what you're doing today?
Yeah, sure. Thanks for having me, David. Glad to be here. Yeah, so I was originally a college baseball coach. Eric's probably heard this story more times than he cares to remember. I was originally a college baseball coach. I thought that's what I wanted to do and not ever have to have a real job, and found myself working way too hard, scouting and giving extra lessons and whatnot to youth, to one of these select teams, and got fed up finally with the hours and the lack of pay. And a physician whose son I had recruited to the college that I was coaching at suggested I get into physician staffings and recruiting. And so I looked into it. Long story short, 30 days later, I was done with baseball and went to work at Merritt Hawkins and Associates, which is now a division of AMN. So I'm coaching this youth team for extra money. I get out of baseball, go to work for Merritt Hawkins. And a year later, one of the dads off that team calls me and says, hey, you got to come back and coach the team. It's gone to pot, and we'll take no for an answer. Essentially, he became the angel investor, what became the Delta Companies. And so I'm not an entrepreneur. I don't think I have an entrepreneur spirit, really. Delta Companies was created back in 97 solely so that I could coach this really rich guy's son's baseball team. That was it, right? So I could make my schedule flexible enough to be available to coach his team. And that's how I got into recruiting and then staffing. And I, you know, was really fortunate to hire on some really, really superstar people early on at the Delta Companies and evolved, obviously grew that business and sold it in 2014. I stepped down as CEO at the end of 16, ended up on a few boards, one of those being Clearly Rated, and made some investments in the staffing industry, went back and did a turnaround for Doximity for 3 years. And then that's been almost 2 years ago that I stepped down from that role. So that's the long-winded version. I hope that was okay. Just my background.
It's great. And it's such a fun story and also really impressive what you've done with Delta and also all of the accomplishments within the company. Eric, why don't you tell the audience a little bit about who you are and your background? You're second time guest, maybe third time. I don't remember exactly, but I know we've had a few things together. So excited to have you here.
Yeah, absolutely. I always enjoy our conversations, Dave. As Jeff kind of alluded to, like he didn't tell the full story. They were our first Net Promoter Score customer at the Delta Companies. Also, the first outside investment we ever took at Clearly Rated was Four Peers, led by Jeff through multiple stages of getting that deal done. And he led our board through the successful acquisition by Software Growth Partners, a private equity firm that we're working with now, which kind of was the encapsulation of what has been about 16 years in the staffing space for me. We started doing surveys, client satisfaction, talent satisfaction, and internal employee satisfaction surveys about 16 years ago and continue to grow. We launched Best of Staffing, which a lot of people know, in 2009 as a response to all the negative economic pressures of 2008. We thought we needed something to celebrate. And so we wanted to shine the light on the firms that were doing a really good job on service. And it kind of took off from there. So really proud of what we've done there. I led was the founder, along with my co-founder, Nathan Goff. And we led the company until the private equity exit. And then I stepped into a role of CXS, which sounds like a NXS cover band, but really is, you know, CX strategist or customer experience strategist. And both you guys know, like, the stuff I like geeking out about is the data and sort of evangelizing the impact that that experience can have on a firm's growth. And so this just gives me more time to do that and really kind of follow my passion, which has been really great.
Awesome. Well, just to say it again, I'm excited to have both of you guys here. You guys, I think, Eric, I'm always listening to what's going on in the market from you. And Jeff, some of your leadership thoughts that you've shared on LinkedIn over the years have been impactful for me, and excited to have the conversation about where things are at in the industry and provide some insights to the audience as well. To kick things off, Eric, let's talk about, like, where market trends, what's going on in the staffing industry today. What are some of the significant things that you see happening right now?
So I think there's some obvious, you know, really impactful trends going on. And you have to overlay the fact that we're in the midst still in December 2024. We're in the midst of the longest, not the deepest, but the longest recession that the industry has ever been in. We're at about 26 straight months of negative year-over-year growth in the industry in terms of revenue and employment. And it's never really been that long. And so as you look at that, I think there's a number of things that are impacting that that I think are good lessons for us as we look at 2025 and beyond. You know, the latest data from ASA is expecting it to be pretty flat, maybe even down slightly in Q1 and Q2 of 2025, and then up, but not up dramatically in Q3 and Q4. And so I know we're going to talk a lot about this. And, you know, as we're preparing for this, both, you know, you and Jeff, I thought, had some really good thoughts and strategies on ways to grow when the rest of the industry is maybe flat or choppy. And I think we'll hit that. But the other thing that I want to kind of drive home on this that I think is a really important trend to watch is that we're getting more pressure from, as an industry, from non-traditional competitors than we ever have before. So it used to be that, look, it, you know, we're kind of competing with other staffing firms for the business. But now, as there's more and more tools, we're competing to people trying to do this on their own in-house. We're competing with, you know, people doing more SOW and services type work. You know, as the inflation drove up the cost of labor, we're seeing more people offshore or automate components that maybe didn't make economic sense when you were paying somebody $14 an hour, but they do if you have to pay them $22 an hour. So I think we have a lot of things that are really beaten against our traditional value proposition. And I think it's now more than ever, we've got to stay really, really close to our customers and evolve as their needs are evolving, as opposed to trying to sell the same suite of services into a wider and wider audience.
Not to mention, Eric, you know, just the online platforms, right? And yes, and not only the Upworks, but even Ubers of the world who continue to tap in.
Well, Jeff, you know, you make a good point. And there's kind of a fill in the blank. And the time that I've been in the industry, when I first came in, it was like, okay, our VMS is going to replace the need for recruiters, right? Because we don't get direct contact. And then it was, you know, are the online platforms going to replace this? And then it was, are the, you know, the sort of the job boards, as they get more progressive, going to replace the recruiter? And now it's, is AI going to replace the recruiter? And I think the answer each time in all of those has been, you know, fill in the blank is going to replace the bad recruiter, the mediocre recruiter, right? The recruiter that can provide context, that can provide relationships, that can really guide people, that recruiter is going to do really well. And I think will continue to do well. But, you know, we're certainly under attack to prove the value that we're creating, not just to create that value, but to prove it.
Yeah, I mean, even going back to the dot-com age, right, we were all going to be replaced initially with the web in general, right, the internet. All the industry's done is, I'm pretty sure, doubled, if not tripled since then. I like to think of it a different, just a slightly different way, and that is, what we're doing each time one of these disruptors, I'll use my quote fingers, right, disruptors is introduced, whether it's the internet itself, whether it's a VMS product, now it's AI, is we've just made recruiters much more efficient. A volume of work that recruiters are able to crank out today is massive as compared to what they were doing 25 years ago. You have to be on the forefront of that. You can't ignore it. You do need fewer recruiters, Eric, today than you did certainly a few years back. And that'll continue to be the case as AI pushes through as well.
I kind of see parallels between this and I've talked about a lot of this and compared to the travel agency world and the travel industry as a whole, you know, where it's the, there are still travel agents, but the roles of those travel agents have changed dramatically, as will, I think, recruiters. And I think that's something we're seeing with the online platforms that are moving forward and then the software that supports them along with that as well. Do you guys feel like the roles will change, but do you feel like the growth projections, the trajectory for the staffing industry will get back on track? I think SIA typically is forecasting that, you know, we're kind of returning to the new normal. I've heard somebody say, if you take 2019 to, you know, now out, just take the whole COVID era out, draw a straight line, you almost end up where you should have been all along. But I'm wondering, like, where you guys see the next, you know, 3 to 5 years of staffing? Do you see it coming back around, and or do you think there is a more significant disruption at play?
I'll start on that and premise this by saying that I've been wrong pretty consistently for almost 2 years. So, and anybody that tells you that they haven't been is lying to you, because we just haven't been able to predict. Like, look at the Wall Street Journal economists and their projections versus the actual jobs data. Like, on average, I ran this since 2022, they have missed by an average of 27%. Mostly they've missed guessing low, and it's been higher than that on overall employment. But like, you miss, I mean, if I missed that level in almost any job, I wouldn't have a job, right? And these are the best and the brightest. And so I think it's really hard to predict. I do worry that some aspect of this problem solving that people went through, whether it was perceived or real, you know, rates being too high, or whether it was perceived or real, you know, opportunity to do some of these things on their own or with some of these enhanced tools or the online platforms, I feel like there's a wider swath of things, that ways that people can get the same work done than there were before. And I think that as we look at that, for us to get back on that same trajectory, we're going to have to redouble our efforts to get credit for the value we are creating and to ensure that we're actually creating the value we think we're creating.
It's going to be better than it has been the last couple of years for the staffing industry at large. If you look at where the job creation is, it just hasn't been in spaces that we typically are around. Like, when almost half of the jobs that have come available to be filled over the last couple of years are at government, like, it just makes it a little bit more challenging to fill those jobs, depending on which, you know, segments you sort of service. So, and at the end of the day, if you're a multi-billion dollar company, yeah, you may face some continued headwinds. Maybe the growth rate isn't quite as what it has been the last 10 years. For most of those companies that are, you know, 20, 50, even $100 million in revenue, there's so much market share you can steal. Who cares if the industry grows or not? You got to go out there and take it away. And there's plenty of bad providers who aren't, by the way, keeping up with the latest tools to keep their recruiters the most efficient, and will continue to lose out. So there's plenty of market share to go win, even if the industry isn't creating a whole lot more over the next few years.
That kind of takes us to the next point of this, which is, Jeff, you've had some exceptionally good thoughts, especially even for me when I've heard it last year on your webinar, about how to, during challenges times, and I'd love to know what some of your recommendations are. And there are niches right now that are doing well, but there's a lot of the staffing industry that is dealing with a more challenging market than usual. And how would you recommend staffing agencies approach this?
Your market is defined as you know, the geographies you service, also the niches and sort of modalities of people that you place. And so it's such a subjective thing to say that the market's down, because if you're in locums in the Dallas-Fort Worth area doing anesthesia right now, you're incredibly happy. On the whole, though, right, if we realize that the industry's flat to maybe down as much as 10%, just on average, what can you do to combat that? I'd start with this, that those that are winning, beating the market, are still growing, perhaps where some sectors of the industry are contracting, they did probably three or four things right prior to this downturn. One, they were super niched. They weren't trying to be everything to everybody. And when you're a subject matter expert in a particular market, not only do you gain a lot of efficiencies internally, but you kind of solidify your place in a down market. It's a little bit counterintuitive to think that in a down market, you need to be more restrictive on what kind of orders you're filling, but it's true. And if you had that discipline prior, you're just a whole lot further ahead than you are today. So that's one thing, being super niche. I think two, you know, hiring gritty and resilient people. I mean, making the gritty factor part of your hiring profile is going to help. And you would only do that if you, as the leader, were probably gritty. That certainly helps. That's a big deal, right? Is having gritty folks to get through what are tough times. Third, I've said this 100 times. I think salesmanship is a lost art. And those that didn't strengthen that sales muscle in the good times are super weak right now. Those nursing companies that relied solely on MSPs to get their orders are struggling. I mean, they're going out of business. They're selling for pennies on the dollar. And salesmanship in this context is the, let's just think about it, is the ability to persuade people to do something that they might not otherwise do. And you could say that this is true of both recruiters, those that are recruiting people or talking them into going and working on assignments. And you could say it's true on the, obviously on the business development, the client side of the equation. But with all the automation on the recruitment side, this mainly impacts the BD side of the equation. And there's just a lot of folks that aren't very good at it. And then finally, I'll say just the competition inside the organization. Peer pressure is probably a leader's best friend, a strong motivator, and really reduces the need for a lot of management. I guess what I'm really telling you, though, is the opposite of what you asked, David. Sorry, right? These are challenging things to do in a down market. So maybe that was advice for what to do in the next up market, right? When times are good.
Well, I mean, I think it's helpful. And I think that understanding even the term I think we all talked about briefly yesterday, I just heard it for my first time this year as well, was the riches and the niches. I think it's one of the, it's a nice way to remember that. And it's so true. I think that Eric, you had some comments about how people tend to go broad.
We see it so often, right? People are like, okay, this isn't working, right? So I'm putting this much in the top of the funnel and I'm getting less out than I thought I would. So that must mean that I need to put more in the top of the funnel instead of trying to sort of fatten that funnel a little bit and make yourself stickier in there. I'll just add to what Jeff's saying, like the sales side of it, you know, when you look at the turnover, we turn over 30 to 40% of our account managers and our recruiters every year in this industry. And so that means that for some organizations, appreciably everybody that is with them today has not actually been here during any kind of a, you know, a need to sell kind of environment, right? They just started, you know, if they started during the pandemic or post, you know, early post pandemic, like they never had to sell in this industry and they don't really have a good idea of how this industry feels. On the flip side, if you started in late 2022, you're going, what was I ever thinking getting into this industry? Yeah. This is really hard. Like it, you know, it's hard and rewarding usually, and it's been hard, but less rewarding for a lot of people on this one. So I do think that you have to lead with that razor's edge of empathy towards the fact that I get, team, that you're working, you know, 30% harder for 20% less, and trying to encourage them that, look, this will come. You're doing the right input things. The output things will come, while also not allowing it to become a distraction or an excuse on that. And then the other thing I wanted to add that I think is a big piece of that, like we sort of ignore sales enablement as an industry. And what I mean by that is we spend a lot on marketing, and then the industries, of all the industries that we are close to, this industry, staffing, just dances circles around everybody else from in terms of the sales professionalism and kind of rigor and performance. And yet we don't really do much to actually give our recruiters, our account managers a leg up when they're in front of a candidate, when they're in front of a hiring manager. And yet, you know, in almost every one of those meetings, they probably have more expertise. Certainly the firm has more expertise hiring than any of the hiring managers that they're working with. And so we don't really translate that well. So, you know, that's, you know, bringing data, thought leadership, examples. And the only way you can really make that impactful is if those examples are really specific to the industry, like Jeff's saying, like got to go deeper, because if you can't really stand out as being one of the top two or three in a particular space, and that might be a combination of region and job, you know, description and, you know, industry as a part of it, if you can't be the top two or three in that space, it's going to be really hard to break through there. I'll just leave with one additional data point that I found is really fascinating. Google did this research where they found that 81% of buyers of B2B services have what they call a day one list. And that means that when they're going out to find, you know, a firm, they have at least a couple of companies in mind that they think could be able to do that. And I thought that was fascinating, right? 4 out of 5 have that day one list. What was even more fascinating is that for those that have a day one list, 92% of the time, who they ultimately selected was from that day one list. We ran this just for the staffing industry, and we found that 64% have a day one list. So still pretty high number, 2/3. 93% actually ended up picking a staffing firm that was already on their day one list. And so that really speaks to, you know, for those of us going back to like marketing 101, where it was like, you know, problem recognition, and then it was awareness, and then it was consideration set, and then, you know, the rest of that buying journey. Like if we're not in that consideration set, you know, in that awareness and that consideration set, it's really an uphill battle to get in there, and it's going to be hard to crack new logos into accounts.
Wouldn't that be a function of marketing to make sure that firm was originally top of mind to be on that list, that initial list?
There's a lot there marketing wise, Jeff. I think because of the unique way that our industry works, you're going to have the opportunity, if you're taking kind of a long play on the sales process, you're going to have an opportunity for sales to influence that as well. If you're adding value, for example, let's say that David's trying to sell me and he's just dialing and smiling and, hey, just wanted to check in, see if you needed anything. You know, hey, just wanted to let you know, are we doing anything? Well, that's not going to, you know, break through much for me. But let's say that you're selling to me and you're calling up and you're saying, hey, I just wanted to, you know, check in with you. I know it's been really busy in the locum space here in Dallas. And, you know, we're doing a lot in this area. You know, if there's ever anything I can do, even if it's not the right time to partner, if you just want to bounce an idea or if you just, you know, want to get my perspective, I see a lot of these, I'd be happy to help. And then the next time you call, you say, hey, we just did a little study and actually looking at the things that locums are searching for if they're going to take, you know, an assignment. And the top three things are X, Y, and Z. Yeah, I'd just love to kind of get your perspective. Is that what you're seeing as well? Most of my clients are really, yeah, that really resonates with them. They're seeing a lot more emphasis on, you know, flexibility than they have in the past. And now you're bringing yourself in and adding that expertise. And when it does come the right time, it's not just the marketing, but now it's the marketing alongside of that relationship building on the sales that's done it.
David, if I could, I'll go back and answer your original question now. Yeah. A long way to get there, but, and I'll start, you know, the question was, I think, right, what tactics can staffing firms employ to generate growth or at least win and beat the competition in a down market? I go back to one that Eric brought up that is brilliant, and that is the word empathy. And when you think about it, you know, empathy is somewhere in between apathy and sympathy, and, right? You don't want to over-index on either one. And just literally defined, empathy means wholly understanding someone's situation, but being completely removed from it as well. And so what happens is this, we get sympathetic, we start over-identifying with these headwinds, right? With this, you know, quote unquote down market. We start actually feeling the pain, and it's really hard to remove ourselves. We become emotional. And when you become emotional, you're less logical. So we got to not over-index one way or the other. And especially right now in that sympathy side. Maybe said another way, leaders have to keep the goals front and center while at the same time understanding that there are difficulties and that leaders got to stay a little bit stubborn to winning. I can fully understand and I'm willing to try to help, but at the end of the day, we have goals to go hit and we've got some stuff we want to get done. So it's a balancing act and very difficult, but I think that word empathy is spot on.
Before we go to the next one, we got to have Jeff talk about, because one of the things that I think matters a lot is how you hold to goals and how long-term or short-term those goals are. And Jeff, you know, you and I have talked a lot about this. You helped us implement the trailing 13. Maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, the value of trailing 13 and shortening your goal windows, because that was absolutely critical for us and us having success at Clearly Rated, you know, going through the pandemic and then really emerging pretty strong out of the pandemic.
Yeah, with KPIs, what are the right KPIs would be the first thing, right? They change over time for different people at different levels, even within the same role, perhaps. I think the best KPIs are empirical in nature, right? Not subjective. And they have to have a linear relationship with your end result, which is really, right, probably profitability, but at a minimum, gross profit dollars. To your point on the T13, if you think submission of a candidate to a client, for clarity, if you think submissions is the right KPI, and I like that one for a lot of reasons. One, the recruiter can control it. They can have an impact on it this week. Whereas if you're measuring people on just gross profit, that's going to happen, you know, weeks and maybe months from now. That's not an indicator by definition. That would be very rare. View mirror kind of stuff. And so the submissions works. To get to your point on the T13, what we said was, look, people are going to have good weeks and they're going to have bad weeks. So to say that you're in good standing this week, but last week you were in bad standing and the week before that you were in good. So what we did is we used a trailing 13 weeks. And I say we did. I still use this in a lot of the companies that I advise today or invest in today. What this does is it removes the excuses from people. If I now look back over a 13-week time frame and see where you're at in the aggregate. So if it's, you know, if it's 10 a week, then in the aggregate, you need 130 over those 13 weeks. Any one week, it shouldn't vary a whole lot. And what you do is you're taking the excuses of a vacation, or I'm going to a conference, or I need to be out with my kids, or whatever the thing is that happens, whatever part of life interrupts, and it always does, you kind of take that excuse out of it. And it's just a more smooth way to look at the world. Yeah, it's just more linear. It makes life so much easier. Yeah. You could probably be more specific about the benefits of it, but conceptually, people will say, "Wait a minute, you're taking a weekly metric and you're turning it into a quarterly metric." No. It's still a weekly metric because we're rolling these 13 weeks. Yeah, but it's been highly effective in every instance I've.
Yeah, and maybe just if you just walk through an example of how you guys implemented this, so that for the audience, say like, here's what it looked like. Here's why we got the math for it. Because I mean, I'm thinking about that with our. You're talking about this. I'm like, is this something I should be put in place for my sales team? Yeah. like maybe.
I can give an example from Clearly Rated, Jeff, because to your point, we have a before and after there in recent memory, but we started to put it into place, David, and we did it on meetings set. So we know pretty reliably that if we're getting, you know, demos of our product, that up 20 to 25% of those will turn into business within about 30 to 45 days. And so what we were doing is we did that trailing 13 on meetings completed. If you take that and you take it down to an average, worked best for us. So, you know, let's say that, you know, we needed to have an average of, you know, 4 meetings completed. Well, let's say that somebody's averaging 3 meetings completed. Your goal is always just to be above that trailing 13-week average. If you're always above, if every single week is above, even if it's above by, you know, 3.2 or 3.0, you know, but if you can be above that average trailing 13, then your productivity is improving and you're improving on that side. And that part was the part that was really crystallizing for us, is that then you can, you know, let's say that I've got 2 AEs. I've got one of them that is consistently hitting 4 and another one that's struggling to hit 3. Like, they have their own metric, right, to get on that piece. And assuming that I'm okay with where they're at on that, my goal can actually be the same for each of them, which is to improve on that trailing 13, stay at or above that trailing 13. And it really simplifies it.
Yeah. And a key part of that that you just said too, is if the end goal is the same for 2 people or 200 people, it doesn't matter. If the end goal is the same, and I believe it largely should be the same, then how many submissions it takes to get to some level of placements and subsequent gross profit, like that submission level is not the same. It's based on their skill set. It's based on their ability to convert, right? So if it takes somebody 10 submissions to get a placement, sorry, you're going to have to stay late and work on the weekends. If it takes somebody 2, congratulations, you're really proficient. That's not going to make me raise your goal next year. It's just going to make your workload a lot more digestible, right? So of course, that all comes with this idea that not 2 people have I believe everybody has the same goal. Per a level of tenure, right? Somebody that starts first day doesn't have the same goal, but like people that have been there more than a couple of years at any company that's doing sales, my philosophy is they should have the same goal. Because here's the alternative, and this is disgusting. The alternative is somebody has a breakout year and does twice what anybody else has ever done. And then what does the leader do? They come back to that person and they go, "Hey, could you do 10% more next year, please?" Right? And what if they can't? That's like Phil Jackson having gone to Michael Jordan and went, "Hey, you scored 86 last night. Congratulations. We're going to need 88 tonight."
Yeah. Yeah, we like, budgeted 86 for you.
Yeah, right. It's just silly. It's
you know, you can do it now.
Congrats on the success. It's harder for you now.
It's a really good point. And then the other thing that I think comes with that too, is that like the choppier the economic headwinds are, the choppier the results are for your firm, the more you need to celebrate daily, weekly input level goals. Because one thing, Jeff, you said that is really true is Like, there's a lot of variables that lead into us closing a new account, or, you know, you getting a new placement on the, you know, on the staffing side of it. And we can't always control all those things, right? Timing changes, the client changes, you know, our talent flakes out or takes another job or whatever. But you can control certain inputs. And we know that if we have enough of those certain inputs, that eventually the dam's going to break and we're going to start getting the, you know, start to be able to reap what we sow.
Yep. Yeah, I think, you know, that was one of the things I'd written down as a way to win in a down market is celebrating, giving people a reason to be positive, find those wins, no matter how small, and really do a good job using a megaphone to get those out to everybody else. The other thing that happens there is you find best practices. You know, if George over here had some success doing things this way, we should not only celebrate that success, we should dig into how, so that other people can figure out the, you know, that same pathway perhaps to being successful. I mean, if you want people to believe it's possible, give them those real world examples internally that happened. But what happens so many times is, you know, if you have a staff of, I'm making this up, if you have 10 recruiters and six of them are doing well, but four of them are not, you end up really myopic on those four that are not, and you're demotivating the six that are. Right. And one of your jobs as a leader is to not demotivate. Does that make sense? Is that a double negative, Eric? I don't know. Anyway, you got to find a way to put those, you know, five or six people, right? Or even if it's four people that are winning, put them on a pedestal. Don't let them be poisoned by not only the Debbie Downers over there, but by you, kind of your frustration level as a leader. Keep the winners winning and keep them out of harm's way. That's a very basic requirement of leadership. And then for those that are off track, don't get mad. Like, don't take it so personal, right? I mean, it's sort of a selfish position and it doesn't motivate a soul. And I use soul as in S-O-U-L, not S-O-L-E. Like, it doesn't motivate. So instead, what leaders I think need to do in times like this is they get curious. Just keep asking why. Why is this happening? Why is that happening? Why? And help add value to solving these problems and which really are these headwinds.
With implementing this, the trailing 13 week, which I think is amazing, probably going to go back and do that at my business. And I heard about it for the first time from you yesterday talking. I was already talking to my team about it. What type of operating rhythm do you have with your sales teams and your org to make sure that you are celebrating the wins, to make sure that you're getting them on board and moving things forward?
I would suggest, right, depends on how large the organization is. In general, I would say you need to have a Monday, first thing every Monday morning is the what I call the accountability meeting. You call it whatever you want, but it's an accountability meeting, which really is very simple. We go around to the team of, you know, 8, 10, 12 people, whatever, and we say, what were your commitments to the team last week? How did we do? And maybe you dig into one or two of those. And then the second part of the meeting is, okay, what are our commitments for this week? That meeting is critical. In addition to that, you have a one-on-one every other week with your sales reps. Then you have a maybe a monthly business review meeting. But here's the key. Whatever your rhythm and your meeting cadence is, when you're underperforming, cut it in half. If you used to do like an all hands once a month, in tough times, it may make sense to do an all hands every other week or maybe even every week, right? Anytime you have a rep that's underperforming, one of the first things you do is the accountability period, the period in between maybe those one-on-ones gets reduced and it goes to daily. Maybe it goes to, I'm going to meet with you before lunch and at the end of every day. So the worse people or a person is performing, you continue to cut that meeting cadence and get more frequent updates because people have suggested just by the sheer fact they're not executing that they can't handle that much time. And so it's our responsibility as leaders to get in there and help them by cutting those accountability periods down in half.
That's great. That's great advice and something I'm probably going to be rolling out as well. One of the things that I know, and you were talking about celebrating wins and getting that into kind of a faster rhythm as well. Any recommendations for team morale? And I know we're talking about the market as a challenging thing. There's a lot of wins, a lot of things to be optimistic for. But I think it's important for the people that are having, maybe not hitting the goals that they want to hit, to dig into this and give some insights on it. But any thoughts around, you know, what you can do to keep morale up and to make sure that, and this goes back to the empathy and accountability thing as well, but like, how do you push and make sure people are feeling good about the push?
I've got some thoughts. Eric, you want to go?
Yeah, I'll start with just a couple things on there. The first of which is, I think that's when authenticity as a leader is really put to the test. the second that feel like you're not being honest with them, they know, right? Jeff, you and I talked about this when we were at Staffing World, and you talked about it as being one of the mistakes. You tried to shield too much from the team as opposed to saying, hey, here's where we are. Let's collectively climb out of this. And I think that anything that starts to sniff as like, I'm not getting the full picture, or I'm not, or they're pretending that this isn't hard, that's a real turnoff to employees. So I think you have to, you know, you have to acknowledge that piece. And then you just celebrate the wins. You celebrate everything that you can and paint a picture to the outside. I was thinking back, I was just talking about this the other day, Jeff, with someone. One of the things that we found when we were doing the internal employee surveys at Delta, and we've now kind of implemented across there, is that employee net promoter score, so how likely they are to recommend ABC staffing company as a great place to work, that is a moderate predictor of their likelihood to churn. And what that means, it makes sense, right? If I rate, really rated a 4, it makes sense that I'm more likely to leave. But what we found, we also asked another question, which is overall, are you optimistic about your next year at Clearly Rated? Yes, no, simple yes, no. And what we found is that if you combine the two of those together, you get a much stronger predictor of turnover. And so if somebody was a detractor, they weren't necessarily likely to leave as long as they still were optimistic about the year ahead. It was when you actually got somebody that was frustrated in the present and also did not see how that frustration was going to abate in the future that was going to be a part of that. So I think we have to be authentic, but we also have to paint as leaders, like, we don't want to lead through the muck the entire time. Like, we have to have some vision as to a better tomorrow, no matter whether we're doing great and we can do even better, or we're struggling and we're trying to get to good. And so we have to paint that picture in a way that resonates with them so that they can feel like they're in a tough part of the journey, but that the journey is going to get better, not easier, because it doesn't get easier. To quote, I think, is the Duke women's basketball coach, like, we handle hard better. And I think that's a really important lesson.
Yeah, that's well said. The authenticity, you're right, is so critical. Another way of thinking about this, if you're as a leader burying your head in the sand and not communicating why these headwinds exist and what they do to impact our business, then one, you either don't know, or two, you think people are stupid or not worthy. You got to talk about those things. The authenticity part comes in when we say, well, I'm not sure exactly what to do about this. But if you get people involved in the problem, they'll help you solve it. And that's the mistake that I made one time that Eric referred to. You got to let people know, not only this is where we're at, this is where the industry is, this is where the economy is, whatever. You've also got to say, here's what we're going to do about it. And again, use them to help make that plan. Then you got to get really specific. All right, when would there be another cut? It has to happen for us to avoid laying off more people. If you really want people to care and be involved and get on the solution side, they have to know. And that's our responsibility. I think asking their opinions is again, huge in all of this. As Eric said, and I'll tell the story, I'll try to be brief, but in 2009, due to the credit markets and what was happening, we had a cash flow crunch at Delta, and I knew we would get out of it. I was very confident in that. The thing is, I just kept it from people because I didn't want them to worry. But the truth leaks, and in a vacuum, the truth becomes really more grotesque than it is. Like, it becomes a much darker story than what exists. And that happened. And I lost a lot of trust. In hindsight, if I'd have gone to the company and said, hey, here's where we're at, here's our plan to get out of it. If I increased the frequency then of those meetings and any time to get together, celebrated the small wins along the way, I know we would have gotten out of a lot sooner, just being more authentic and truly transparent about the situation.
And so you alluded to even, you know, letting people know, hey, here's where we're at from a cash perspective.
Yep.
We've got 6 months. Here's the numbers we need to hit to make it so that we're not having to experience the pain that we know comes with that. And do you share that leaders only, company wide? What kind of level does that transparency come through?
I'm a fan of company wide. We did that. We showed EBITDA. But here's the thing. If you're in a down market and you're trying to show people a plan and you need to talk about profitability and they've never seen or have any concept of what profitability is before, it probably isn't the right time to introduce the concept. Again, going back to the real leaders do the heavy lifting in good times to prepare. Yeah. We always were transparent about our EBITDA goals and where we were against those. And then through that, right, you educate people over time into the things that impact your profitability. as a result, then, right, when down markets, they understand it. You know, I'd be a little cautious if you've never introduced this concept to people of just sort of dumping it on them and expecting they're going to get it, right, because you're in a down market.
One of my favorite books, The Great Game of Business, and Jack one Stack. Of the leaders, Jack Stack. Have you read that book, Jeff?
Oh, yeah, of course. Yeah, it's great.
Yeah. So the story, I may butcher the actual numbers, but I believe that it took over a manufacturing facility that did a lot of the OEM manufacturing for, I believe, General Motors or in the automotive space. And they were 89-1 debt to equity ratio. They tried to get additional funding. I think they got turned down from like 70 straight banks. And we're just on this really tight rope, just about to run out of money. And they were kind of desperate. And they ultimately just opened up and told the entire company what was going on. And then they realized like, oh, nobody can really understand this because we've not done a good job of building proficiency around what these metrics are, how the individuals can impact them. But long story short, they really put together kind of a entry-level college, you know, business and financial reporting class. And they had, you know, ideas coming from everywhere that were able to cut costs and make things, you know, significantly more efficient and was really key to their success and then ultimately led to them writing the book. Just a great illustration of the power that can come if you're willing to engage the entire organization in the challenges you're trying to overcome.
Yeah. It's a great example of a leader putting pride to the side and being authentic, being transparent. And when you do that, people are so motivated to help. They're so dedicated and engaged in solving the problems. I don't know why more leaders don't do it. I think it's a pride thing, or maybe they just don't really like people. I don't know.
It's actually really interesting. I think most layoffs I hear about seem to come as a surprise to like most of the organization, which is, it's like the entire organization team is frequently caught off guard. And it's like, well, could people have helped if they knew? And if they understood the situation, and what would have changed had they been able to be aware that this was coming?
And then everybody else in the organization is puckered up and probably looking for another job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and yeah. I think a lot of it comes from shame and insecurity as a leader, right? Because, you know, when we've gone through challenging times, I've certainly battled this and I've gotten to the place where I was really transparent with pretty much the whole organization. It was hard to do because I felt like I had failed them. So there's a part of that, that even if you believe that it's the right thing to do, you have to really remind yourself the importance of that, because some of it can be ego, but some of it can honestly just be, you know, feeling of shame that you've let people down.
Great point. Great point.
That's great guidance. Now we're going to jump over to a few more ideas around generating growth. Wanted to talk to you guys about the importance of innovation during challenging times. Like what role does that play in helping people come out of the market conditions?
I call it creativity, not innovation, maybe semantics, but when I think about innovation, I think about a product development or something new. Maybe innovation requires some downtime and some budget, which we don't have in a market like we're in. So when old methods don't work, you got to get creative. And so I think of the word creative, and you got to be creative, not necessarily in what you do, but how you go about doing it, how you sell, how you market. Maybe it's who you're selling to specifically, the pace of closing. You've just got to be incredibly creative and open to change. One of my favorite quotes by Ed Deming is, "Change isn't necessary. Survival is an option." Right? And so in these markets, it's like, man, if you can't figure out a more creative way to get to the decision makers, to get the decision makers to say yes, to get the orders, then, you know, wow, that old saying that, what is it? Necessity is the mother of invention.
Yeah.
If that's true, then what's really required of us as leaders is to make it necessary, right? To paint a compelling reason that this is where we're at. This is the plan to get ahead. And with that comes the necessity of them getting creative and finding new ways to get shit done. Like, it just, for me, it's all about that. It's about that creativity.
Yeah. You bring up a really good point, Jeff, too, because I don't know if you remember, you know, we talked about this with Clearly Rated, and as we were coming out, we were getting really catching a strong up cycle with the business coming out of COVID. After we'd gotten through the sort of scariest times from a business standpoint of COVID, we were doing really well. And some of the things that we were taking away, one of the things that I was trying to make sure that we were able to keep going, you know, that we didn't lose as we came out of that, was two things. The first of which was that, you know, sort of weekly commitment to winning and winning the week as opposed to sort of a monthly goal or a quarterly goal. And then the second piece of that I really wanted to hold on to is, you know, we'd gotten in the habit of, we would come up with a new idea or something that we could try. And, you know, we had a really great tenure. The downside to really great tenure is that everybody has been there long enough to think of the last time you tried something like that. And because it didn't work 6 years ago, we're certain it's not going to work now. And during COVID, we were much more, we started with the posture of like, we've got to make it work. So instead of saying that won't work because of this or this, we would say, okay, I don't know if that'll work, but what if we did this and this, right? And so we would build on that creativity instead of shutting it down. And I do think that that's important. And this is the time that you guys stay really, really close to your customers. I had the privilege of interviewing Jeanette Marks from AirSwift, Jeff, who you know well from the ASA board, and David, I think you maybe know as well. And I was asking her kind of how they approach sort of this economic cycle and downside. And she said, you know, to be honest, we just do more of what we've always done, which is instead of having a suite of services that we sell into a customer and prospect pool, we have a suite of customers that we go and build the services that they need. That was kind of ground shaking to me, you know, this idea. But what she was really saying is like, we're going to start with the customer and what the customer needs. And then anything that is within our area of expertise that we could do that adds value to the customer and that they're willing to pay for, we're going to sort of build that for them. And it's just a hyper customer centric view that I think does really, really well in a down economy. It's all part of what we started with, Jeff, of going more narrow and deep instead of trying to increase your universe.
Jeanette is a next level leader, to say the least.
She's fantastic. Fantastic.
Really unbelievable. And speaking of unbelievable leaders, Eric, I'm going to give you some props here. So going back to experimenting and being creative and trying things at Clearly Rated when there were some significant headwinds, I give you credit because you were a leader who really allowed that and permitted that creativity to happen. There's a balance that has to occur. You as a leader have to provide some guardrails on what's permissible and what's not in sales activity with anything within the organization, but in this context, the sales activity. But you got to balance that with, let's go try some stuff, see what works, and then build upon it. There is going to be some non-negotiables. If we're in the business of placing IT developers, we're not going to go take job orders for positions, right? Like, there are some guardrails that have to be in place, but how they go and source that business, how they fill it, you've got to allow some entrepreneurship and some creativity as a leader. And this is an art, by the way, right? This balancing is an art, but without it, you know, to expect people to suddenly get creative in a down market is a little bit more difficult.
That's great advice. And I kind of tagging along with that a little bit and understanding your clients, understanding your customers, understanding your candidates, making sure that you're attuned with people that actually drive your business. Eric, could you talk a little bit about kind of like, how do you do that? How do you make sure that you have a clear understanding of what your customers need and also tying that back into the talent side as well?
I was actually talking to Andrea Breinholz, who's one of the new ASA board members earlier today. She runs an IT staffing firm and they've done a really good job with their rehire rate, which is for the industry is one of the most challenging things. And I was kind of digging into that a little bit with her, you know, is it that they focus more on it? Is it this? And what I kind of distilled out of that conversation was where most staffing firms are managing an order from the order start to the order end. And the journey is that order and the arc of that order. Her firm is actually managing the experience of their consultants. And so they're viewing the arc of that journey far beyond a single placement. And so they're managing that piece of it and then sort of matching up the job orders that fit the skill set and the interests as a part of it. And it's kind of a nuanced difference. Like, I think maybe when people hear that, they might go, well, I think we do that too. I don't know that that's really true. I think that if we really kind of look in the mirror, most of us are managing a job order, and it's as that job order ends, then we look at, okay, now what do we do with the person on the job order and what do we do to get the next job order? When in reality, if we were looking at that consultant, that job order would just be a milestone in the greater journey. And so I really like the way that she was thinking about that. And I do think that that journey-based approach is really critical. And the reality is that one of the reasons why I'm not bullish on a 10%, 15%, 20% year-over-year recovery for us coming out of this is even if the supply dramatically increased, and I do think the supply will increase year-over-year this next year, I'm sorry, the demand, the supply is still really, really tight. People aren't quitting jobs right now. We went through the Great Resignation. Now we're back to quitting at a level that's less than pre-pandemic level. We've got really low unemployment. We don't have a lot of layoffs. And so there's just not a tremendous amount of movement. When you look at, you know, kind of taking off after the other recessions, we had this pool of talent that was just waiting for the demand to get back there. And that pool of talent is still really, really tight. So when we have somebody that's a good employee that we can place on an assignment, and we're not doing everything we can to A, keep them on that assignment as long as possible, and B, manage them throughout the life cycle beyond a single assignment, we're doing that at our own detriment on growth. And so, and then take the customer side, one of the biggest things that we're seeing is like we're kind of getting a little bit myopic in how we look at the customers. It's either like they're there or they're not there. And we're not thinking about it from the growth standpoint and identifying new opportunities within those existing accounts, which are almost always the biggest opportunities for growth, way bigger than a brand new logo as a part of that. So those are kind of some of the areas that we see people really, we're encouraging people, and we're seeing some people really dive in terms of trying to navigate the course of a somewhat choppy macroeconomic environment. Yeah.
A couple of things on that is like, one, I mean, I think you're talking about like measuring the solution, like how well are you doing in terms of delivering the solution you're supposed to solve? And I think a lot of times when I talk to staffing agency owners, it feels so transactional. And so like, hey, we got a placement, we're good, move on to the next placement. And the reality is like, if the quality of the hire isn't right, if you're not getting to a spot where the company feels good about working with you for a longer period and managing that journey to see, did the outcome actually happen? You're not going to have that longer term relationship is an element of it.
And you see that, David, right? I mean, you look at the work that you guys do on the referral side, that number one most important thing on the referral side is to provide an experience that's worth referring. And then you guys do a great job of, if that's in place, of amplifying the impact that you can have with a really well-designed, well-architected, well-executed referral program. But at the core end of it, if you're not actually ensuring that that experience itself is one that's worth talking about in a positive way, none of the rest of it really matters.
It is funny when you think about this. People are, we talk about referrals a lot, and some people are like, oh, we want to launch a referral program. It's like, well, if you don't have a solid platform and a solid experience, if you're not delivering referable moments and you haven't measured your experience effectively, might not be the right time. If your Google reviews show that everybody hates you, don't go focus on your referral program. That's not the right move.
If everybody hates you, you better be dang good at business development. And as we said earlier, right? That's just not a muscle a lot of people tend to exercise. So yeah.
Jeff, yesterday, one of the things that we think I heard you say is like the idea of calling yourself a staffing firm and maybe shifting to more of a, I don't know if you were alluding to more of a shifting to a solution sale. I think that's something I've seen a lot of lately is companies going in and being like, hey, we're not just staffing. We are actually here to help with more of the solution side of that.
Yeah. I have a little bit of a counter view on that because we'll hear people be like, we're trying to distance ourselves from staffing. Yeah,
I've heard that a few times.
And I'm like, that name means it's not like people, hiring managers sitting around like wondering whether or not what all falls under the staffing umbrella. The reality is that a brand is what you make of it, and the value that you add and the problems that you solved are either valuable or they're not. And if they're valuable, then it doesn't really matter sort of where you sit. You know, is it solutions? Is it staffing? Is it, as long as it's not confusing to the end user, I think the brand that you build in the market matters more than kind of how you position yourself under one of those umbrellas.
Yeah. Positioning is a big deal with all the competition, right? The industry's gotten so big over the last decade, and there's a lot more alternatives, as we mentioned earlier, whether it's the online platforms or some of the technology that's made the end user customer a little bit more proficient in recruiting themselves, whatever it is, it's made it just a little bit more difficult to win new business. So you better find a unique proposition, right? It's always been that way, but I think more than ever, it's important that you have some unique way to get people's attention so that you can win them over and eventually win their business and get some job orders from them. You better be unique in your approach.
Do you have any favorite examples of either how to create that unique value proposition or of unique value propositions where you felt like a staffing firm really dialed in and excelled because they stood out?
I do, but I'm someone who wants to see these companies. I don't have their permission to be.
I didn't mean to put you on the spot to call out a company, but just curious. But
I could probably think of one, but Eric maybe knows of one. Just, you know, he deals with so many different companies.
There's actually a firm out here, and I'll leave their name out as well. It's not important for this portion of it, but they've got an entire, you know, campaign, the website, everything is around sort of shining the light and making the star of the light industrial employer. And as opposed to it just being a job title, it is a career and it is, you know, aspirational, and they shine the light on all of the great work that gets done by, you know, blue collar employees in trade jobs. They've got an alumni program on it. Like, it's a point of pride to get placed into a light industrial job by this regional staffing firm that's out here on the West Coast. I've not seen that. I've not seen anybody else really be able to brand that community in that way. I was very impressed with that. I'll go one step further and just give a rubric that somebody shared with me a while back that I thought was really valuable. Is you can make claims in how you position your firm, and those claims can be can, should, have to. And, you know, the way that you would look at that is, you know, you can use ABC staffing firm to find talent. You should use ABC staffing firm because they have a great reputation, their service levels are high, and they're award-winning in multiple ways. You have to use ABC staffing firm if you want access to, you know, the hiring guide for the positions that we hire for. If you want to work with the leading firm in our region, if you want. And obviously, the further down you go on those, the more valuable that proposition is. And if you find yourself, if you kind of look at all the ways that you're kind of positioning yourself and they all kind of fall in this can, or maybe can and some should, it's not strong enough. You haven't tailored your offering specifically enough to be able to do that.
That's excellent advice. I haven't heard that, and that's great. I feel like I always come away with so many tips from the conversations with you guys. The next up here is I wanted to jump into measuring performance side of things, and then we'll wrap up after that. Any advice on how agencies should be looking at measuring the performance of their firm effectively?
Measuring the performance of their firm. Well, we talked a little bit about, you know, the KPIs, you know, finding that metric that is actionable, that they can control, and what they can get done this week. And I think that's key. Having a good meeting rhythm and meeting cadence. I think sometimes I say that and people just sort of gloss over, like, no more meetings. There needs to be a reason and a rhyme for how you go about that. There has to be a time and an end date for those metrics to be counted at the end of the day, right? So that's what the meetings are really there for. I think it's important too, just to talk about, when you talk about performance, right? There's, if people can't hit a prescribed goal of submissions, using that as an example again, in a week, there's two reasons why. One would be they lack the motivation, or two, they lack the skill set. And both of those are the responsibility of the leader. If you find somebody that lacks the motivation, likely you either had a bad hire and you didn't hire for drive, which is, I think, you know, we talked about hiring for grit earlier. Those are two really key attributes that I would look for in a new hire is grit and then drive. So maybe your lack of motivation comes from a bad hire, or maybe you're doing things as a leader to demotivate. You got to get in there and sort of diagnose that. If it's a lack of skill, it really is on the leader, right? Because we need to be transferring skill, spending time with people, getting them up to speed. To answer your more broad question, though, about sort of what are the metrics that you would look for? What are the key indicators you would look for? Obviously, I'm a big fan of Net Promoter Score. I was Eric's first Net Promoter client years and years ago, and we used that. Like, having the score there is one thing. Doing something about it is totally different. So the metrics are important, but it's, you know, it's kind of like what you do with that information that really matters. And I was really proud of the way we went about using those metrics to really shape our business.
Yeah, I tell people all the time, you can get a lot of things wrong with how you measure the employee experience, how you measure the experience of the talent that you place on assignments, how you measure the customer experience. You can get a lot wrong with how you measure that and overcome that and still improve it, as long as you're getting that information to the frontline people that are impacting that experience. You're making them care about it. And making them care about it is not really in a punitive way. It's largely making them care about it because they're proud of it, right? And because they want to deliver. Like the vast majority of people want to deliver good service. Some people have trouble sleeping at night if a customer is upset with them. Like those are great people to have in a lot of ways on the service side of it, because they're going to go that extra mile. And especially if they think that you're paying attention to it as a leader. And so those are the places I think when you're looking at performance, especially if maybe the financial piece isn't there. And as a leader, part of it is like continuing to get your team primed. So when the market is ready for you to, instead of going up a little, to go up a lot, you've got the business in there that can support that. And that means, you know, having KPIs that are leading indicators like the Net Promoter Score, like submissions.
I think the most, sorry to interrupt you, Eric, I think the most underutilized metric is the internal Net Promoter.
Yes.
When you came out with this as a product, I was jumping up and down, right? Like I was so elated. It made such a big difference. You know, if you really want to know what's going on inside of your organization, just ask. You guys built a tool that was just amazing at providing you feedback so you knew what it was you needed to go adjust along the way. Like that to me is the most underutilized metric, I think, is people don't measure in their engagement. Like it's just crazy to me.
We just accept 30 to 40% turnover of our frontline employees. And there's nothing, I don't think there's anything that we do that is more damaging to our brand and the consistency of our growth than that, like full stop.
It's so expensive. It's so expensive. You know, the old adage, you got to shut the back door in order to allow people in the front door. That's how you grow. Like, it's just crazy to me that people aren't more, just more obsessed or even paranoid about this. They get lulled to sleep. We get lulled to sleep that, oh, well, it's just, you know, it's going to be 30%. That's what a bunch of BS we tell ourselves, what a bunch of lies we tell ourselves that it has to be that way.
You know, we've done enough with that data. We know that the typical firm is in that 30 to 40%. There's, you know, one in five firms are down below 20%. Imagine what a lead that is. You know, that's like running the 100-yard dash and starting at, you know, 25 yards in ahead of everybody.
Say those metrics again.
So the typical firm is turning over 30 to 40% of their recruiters and their account managers. 20% of the firms are turning over less than 20% of the account. So basically half of that number is their turnover. And so for those firms, it's a massive advantage, right? And we ran this back of the envelope before, I think, Jeff, with you, where we were saying, okay, let's say you've got a recruiter, you know, they're generating, you know, just let's say $20,000 a month in gross margin, and they leave, it's going to sit empty for 3 or 4 months. The new recruiter is going to take 3 or 4 months to get up to speed.
Oh my God.
So, I mean, we just have basically picked the luxury car of your dreams, and we've driven two of them off a cliff.
I think it's closer to 10 of them. You never get that time back.
You never
get that time back.
I've heard the turnover of an employee is half of their annual salary. Like that's the cost to your business. It's like if you lose
that. No, it's 10 times that, David. Like I'm telling you, it's just, it's massive. You can't get that time back. It just, because somebody for 6 months that, you know, you finally run them off or they finally quit and then you got to start over. Like you can't
get that. Opportunity cost. Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
Well, and the way that everybody calculates it is the cost, right? Yeah. And what we're talking about is the impact on growth.
Yeah.
Because when you look at the opportunities that get lost in this industry, especially, like it's not that just then gets distributed amongst everybody else. It doesn't, right? There's such a individualized contributor role in this industry that if somebody's gone, that is just lost growth. Whatever you grew less on that side.
Do you have any data that shows what that actually, the correlation between the reduction in turnover and growth? Is that something that exists?
Yeah, you know, I don't think we have the full data picture on that yet. I'm sure it exists. We know that we did do a study a while back where we looked at tenure was positively correlated with growth. And then we know, for example, that customers that are promoters are, you know, about 60% less likely to churn than detractors are. Yeah, so we've got some of that data, but in terms of the internal turnover, there's more of that story to be told there.
It's not only about growth. I would argue that it would be impossible to account for all of the drag on growth, because when 40% of your staff is turning over every year, there's an aura or an ethos of, wow, what's wrong with this place? Even for those that are there, right? Yeah. So that in and of itself is damning. On top of the growth, it's the profitability. I don't know how anybody has 40% turnover and is able to gen out the level of profitability that they like. That's so expensive. So it's just massive, right? Hiring the right people, having the right systems for them to really flourish and execute to a high degree, keeping them there is, I mean, it's just paramount to growth and profitability.
And Jeff, one last part that I wanted to kind of touch on is you brought up a couple of times the importance of grit and motivation in the hiring process. Any tips on how you identify that for those people that are going out there and looking for their next new hires?
Yes. What we at Curative, the last company that I was running, what we did was we got together and we came up with four, maybe five attributes. And, you know, my input was grit and drive, self-motivated were two of them. And the group came up with the other two or three. Then we said, all right, with grit, what would be in a group setting, in a couple of different settings, a couple of different times, how would we know? What would a candidate say, sitting across from us interviewing? What would they say, or what could we look at on their resume, right, or on their LinkedIn or whatever? What could we identify? And we came up with 20 questions for each of those four or five attributes that would help us flesh out whether they were gritty or not.
That's great.
I don't remember the exact questions. Yeah, maybe on the next time you have me on, we could go through those. I'll figure out how they are. It's just about what is it that you're trying to flesh out and really understand? And then what are the questions that are going to get us to go through that? Then the key for us was having multiple people ask those questions at multiple interviews, compiling those results and seeing if, in fact, they were really gritty or not. It's not bulletproof, but it was as close to bulletproof as we could get.
Well, and sometimes like just ask them to tell a time when they displayed grit. Like, you know, we've asked that question before. We've also asked the question of, explain a time when you got like, wow, exceptional service. If those two stories come back and you're like, that's just doing your job. That's not gritty or that, you know, you should have expected that. That's like mildly above average.
Right. I showed up for work on time 2 weeks in a row.
Exactly. I didn't miss an entire day unplanned. Great. That's your job. That's what you should be doing. Like, that's not grit. That's, you know, basic attendance. And so if they can't articulate what great service looks like, that's one of the questions we ask, or what an example where they felt like they displayed grit, then they probably don't have it.
Yeah. Behavioral based interview questions are key. I agree.
Yeah. I love it. Last two questions I've got for you guys for the speed questions, and then we'll wrap it up. So
I don't think we've done anything speedy so far, Jeff. So this is our real time.
What advice do you wish you were given before entering the staffing industry?
Before entering the staffing industry. Maybe it's just top of mind. We just talked about it. If I could go back and do it all again, can I ask my own question? Can I just trump your question and ask my own question? I would have just been incredibly disciplined to that sort of ICP as it pertains to the internal hire, that ideal candidate profile. I want people with grit. I want people with drive and pick the other things. And I would have just hired so much better, so much sooner and could have had so much more success than we did have. That was the thing that took me forever to figure out.
That's great.
Yeah. The advice I would give is always growing. Obviously, as a company that opens a lot more doors than a static company, but just in your professional, be seeking out opportunities to network with people that are doing interesting things, to learn new skills. Nobody is going to care about your professional development as much as you do. And so really take ownership in that.
I love it. And what book or books have you given most as a gift or have been most influential to you? I know we already talked about The Great Game of Business. So we got that one as a checkbox.
Yeah. There's two that I really like. And they kind of go hand in hand with one another. So I like Malcolm Gladwell's books. I think The Tipping Point is a really interesting thought exercise. And then there's an author brothers, who wrote a book called Made to Stick, which is to me like the handbook that goes along with The Tipping Point. And then I'll add one other one to that, which is the Malcolm Gladwell Speaking with Strangers, I think it's called, is a really eye-opening book about sort of how we get into assumptions and when they're not appropriate.
To answer your question directly, the two books that I've given away most as gifts, without a doubt, one is What Got You Here Won't Get You There by Marshall Goldsmith. I think that is just an incredible book for people trying to mature as leaders, trying to really grow their stature as leaders. And the other one is called Primal Leadership. What's the author's name? He's the emotional intelligence guru.
I know who you're talking about.
I can see his face anyways, but it's called Primal Leadership. The first third of that book, maybe half, changed me as a leader for the better, I hope. Really had a profound impact on me. Yeah, Goleman. Thank you. Daniel Goleman. That book had a profound impact. So I give those two books as gifts as much as anything. Yeah. I mean, more than any other book for sure. Yeah.
I love it. I really appreciate having you guys on today. The conversation was lively, insightful. Yeah, it was just great.
David, what about you? What about your books? What are your books?
My book, Influence by Cialdini. That's number one. He has another one, Pre-Influence, pretty much all of his stuff. Oh gosh, big on Audible. And I go through them so fast, I don't even remember the names half the time now. A new one that I've just been getting into and I'm drawing a blank, but Influence is like one. I think every person should read it, not just for business, but for the sake of understanding how we are influenced to do things. It's a great story of a psychology professor who goes out and understands like what makes a car salesman sell and why do we, I think like a foundational sales book, but also just for understanding how and why we operate the way we do.
That's Influence?
Influence, yep.
Right. That's great. I don't know about you guys, but I've just not found incredible books the last few years, it seems like. No. I've searched it, so I'm grateful for that, David. I'm going to go look that one up.
Newest one is Software as a Science. Another thumbs up. That's probably pretty specific, but it's a good one.
Software as a Science.
Yeah, well, I appreciate you guys being on. Any closing comments for the audience?
Glad to be here. Hope we added some value and always enjoy the conversation when you guys are involved.
Yeah, same here.
I would agree with that. I would just say, you know, it's been a tough road. There's better days ahead for the industry. I really believe that, but I don't see high tide rising all boats scenario, which means that we just have to, you know, out execute. You know, there's multiple strategies that will work, but the execution of that, getting to consistently remarkable outcomes, is going to be critical. So
yeah, that's well said, right? There are going to be some winners. There are going to be some losers, and that's a choice.
Yeah.
Period.
Yes.
Love it. Awesome. Well, thank you guys. Have a great day.
Yep. Yeah. Thank you.
Thanks, David.
Thanks for listening to The Staffing Show. Don't forget to sign up for our newsletter at staffinghub.com to never miss an episode. Until next time.